Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And I'm Daryl Etherington.
And this week, we are going to review the new Apple TV Plus series, Mythic Quest. Before we get to that, we should probably talk a little bit about the Oscars, since we kind of did a whole Oscar nominations episode a few weeks back. Did you guys watch the Oscars?
No.
I watched it. All of it. It was the worst. I don't know what happened. So remind me when it was again. Was it Sunday?
It was Sunday night.
Yeah. So here's what happened to me. I get really excited for my weekends in like a really lame way where I have like a movie I want to watch and maybe a show I want to binge and a video game I want to play, maybe some food to cook. And I like, you know, have an amazing weekend to myself and I got really excited about it. And I didn't have anything this weekend. Like it was like, there wasn't a movie I was really excited about watching. There wasn't like any TV show that was really like exciting to me. I did make biscuits, so that was fun. And I had a friend over, so that was fun too. We watched Parasite and I watched it for the second time. So it wasn't as exciting. It would have been great if I had Parasite to look forward to. This is kind of my point. Because by the time that Sunday night rolled around, I was like, well, here's something, I guess, that I could do with everyone else. And I sat through it and I just didn't care for it in any way. I should have changed it the whole time. And yeah, that's what happened. Sorry, that's probably pretty long-winded, but I thought I should give you guys the full scope.
No, I think context is important.
Yeah.
I mean, it is for me, like, I find the Oscars kind of fascinating and like I'm always excited about them, and then the experience of watching them is definitely a little bit of a drag because they go on for so long and there's so many bits that are just not funny at all, and it just seems like everyone's there out of a sense of obligation rather than any like genuine excitement or joy or creativity. And so the ceremony itself is always a bit of a grind. But, you know, it ended on at least for me, on a really high note, because I think there were these, you know, in a lot of ways, like the awards went to what people expected, that, you know, all the acting awards went to the people who had been predicted, the people that I and everyone else who was watching it together put on our, like, you know, Oscar ballots. But then at the very end of the night, I think most people had assumed that 1917, which had won a bunch of the precursor awards, was going to win Best Director and Best Picture. And instead, both awards went to Parasite, which is I think, probably the best movie of the year. I think you can make a case for a number of movies, and it's always a little bit weird comparing. Like, what does it mean for, you know, movies as radically different as 1917 or Parasite for one to be better than the other? But I think you can make a really strong case for Parasite being the best movie of the year. And then what was really remarkable is that the Oscars have never given Best Picture to a movie that's not in English before. So this is really the first time they've given it to an international film, which is just, I mean, it seems long, long overdue. But if they're going to start with a movie, Parasite seems like a good one to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, like, watching it a second time, I thought, I don't know if this is the kind of movie that I'll really love or enjoy a second time through. Not that I didn't adore it the first time I saw it. I thought it was just amazing. But you know, you kind of know how things are going to go, right? So it's like some of the tension is pulled from it. But it did give me the opportunity to really pay attention to kind of the structure of the film and some of the tools and tricks that are used and some of the framing of some of the shots and just the way that these greater themes are woven throughout it. You get to actually, instead of, now that you know the story, you know, you get to pay attention to how it was told. And it just kind of affirmed. I haven't seen 1917 or all of the Best Picture nominees. I've seen like about half of them or some of them. And same for Best Director, I would assume. But I did have this kind of feeling that, like, I don't know how it can't win. You know, it was so good. And then, of course, I went straight into the Oscars and it won. And I think that was, again, without having seen them all, I think that's great. Good on them.
Daryl, have you seen Parasite?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen it. I loved it. It's great. It won. That's good.
It won. That's good. You're lively this morning. Has someone not had oatmeal yet?
No, I don't know. I've nourished myself. Okay. Yeah, I was happy when I saw that happen. I saw it like 2 days later or something because I was not really paying attention to any Oscar stuff. But it was good. It was good. You know, just my usual hesitation around award ceremonies. They're fine. Things, it's good when they work out. It doesn't matter at all otherwise, but it's nice when they actually do recognize people who deserve recognition. And like it's like, you know, the Oscars mostly are stupid, and when they recognize like Brad Pitt, like Brad Pitt doesn't give, who gives a shit? Like, he doesn't need anybody else patting him on the back more, right? Like, it's fine. But with Parasite, it's like, oh, that is really good, and it's probably actually meaningful to someone as opposed to just another plaudit to heap on their massive success and long history of being, you know, like the best in the world.
Privileged.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So that was good, and it was surprising too. I really didn't think they were going to do that, but that's cool. It's cool that they did, and it's cool that Joker didn't win.
Did you guys watch Joaquin Phoenix's speech?
I did.
No.
What did you think?
What did you think?
I thought that both the Joaquin Phoenix and Renee Zellweger speeches were examples of some of the things that we've talked about in past episodes of people giving these sort of political speeches that aren't necessarily the best. With some caveats there that I think in both cases there was a degree of sincerity. It wasn't like they were doing it just to do it. I think particularly in the Joaquin Phoenix case.
Yeah, it felt like it came from his conscience, right? Like mm-hmm. It almost felt like he couldn't not say it.
Mm-hmm. But it was also felt, they both were like kind of like rambly and kind of hard to figure out exactly what they were trying to say. Yeah. And then at the end of his, like, you kind of get, oh, I guess this is about like animal rights and veganism. Okay, sure.
Yeah, that was a little weird. Like it felt like, cause you know, at his BAFTA speech, he did call out the fact that they're just, it was like a room full of white people essentially mm-hmm. giving out white awards. Or awards to white people, not white awards. And he called
them white awards.
And that felt very, you know, like that felt like it was the same kind of thing. Like it came from his conscience. But it was like kind of, it was better executed in my opinion. It was much more crisp and it was like, I'm calling you out and that's what I'm doing. I did it. Let's move on. Whereas this felt, mm-hmm. like you said, like almost like he had, it had been bubbling up. So many different things had been bubbling up, which totally understandable. I think that's true for a lot of us right now in 2020 with an election looming, et cetera, that we have a lot bubbling up to the surface, but he just kind of like didn't have a filter or a plan for it. And it didn't, I don't think it was one as effective as he wanted it to be, or, you know, really coherent enough to be impactful. You know?
Well, I'm just looking at a transcript of it. He's doing some dangerous equivalency stuff here. We feel entitled to artificially inseminate a cow when she gives birth. We steal her baby, even though her cries of anguish are unmistakable. Oh, boy. Ooh.
Yeah.
Already on a bad path here, Joaquin.
Oh, Joaquin. Don't say his name like that. So
isn't that how you say it?
Joaquin. I don't know. It just felt like your tone underneath it was mean.
He's like, because the first thing he says is, which I was like on board with in theory, is that he says, you know, we talk about these different, you know, social justice issues as if they're separate issues, but like we should see them as part of this continuum of injustice. And I totally agree with that, that like when we, you know, when we treat, say, gay rights or the fight against racism or misogyny, like the fight against misogyny, like these are all things that we should see as linked together in some way. And you're like, okay, I'm on board for where you're going with this. And then he starts talking about animals. And I'm like, I agree on some level, but also I don't love the way you linked. This is like maybe the one area where I can't completely go along with you.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. It's like, like it's pretty extreme, right? You have to be, I mean, that's definitely how PETA thinks, and everyone criticizes them all the time for that because they're stupid. Don't email us, but like,
God.
Yeah, it's he looks like a loon. Like he undermines his message by being a total kook now, because it's like gay people are just like dogs, right? Like it's like, oh man, I don't think you read the room right here. I think you did this one a little wrong. And I kind of think I would disagree, Jordan. I feel like he took his spirit awards thing. It was like, good, I'm encouraged. Now I'm gonna really sit down and prepare this one. And this is what he came up with, because.
Yeah, you might be right, actually.
Like, he's not an enlightened guy, right? Like, he's a stupid, loopy Hollywood dude, just like everybody else, where they're, like, in some weird world that they occupy on their own, right? Like, let's be real about it. And
right. He's not on the ground here.
No, no. And this is him expressing himself clearly without the help of, like, people trying to, like, maybe direct him, or with a like on the other one it was genuine and it came from a place of whatever, and then this is him like sitting back and going like, I have too much time on my hand in my palatial estate, I'm gonna like think about this too long, and it's totally disconnected with anybody's lived realities, because what do I know?
I think it's true that he thought about it a lot, but I think the problem is he didn't write anything down. And the same with Renee Zellweger, it seemed like they just went up and kind of were like, I'm going to speak from the heart. Which, you know, if that's fine, like if you, I think, but you got to start. It's like the same thing when we talk about our own events, which obviously are not Oscar scale yet, but it's like, great, like over prepare. And then if you want to be spontaneous, but don't just roll up with nothing and assume that it will all just come to you, because that usually doesn't end well.
Yeah.
I think the one other thing we should touch on is just from a streaming perspective, Netflix, you know, in a lot of ways, this was their best nomination year ever. They received 24 nominations, more than any other studio. But then at the end of the night, all they had was two awards, which, I mean, I wrote the story as Netflix's movies only won two Oscars this year, which some people were kind of tweeting a little bit skeptically about, of like, oh no, like they only got two Oscars, like, and you know, fair enough, they got two awards. I'm sure like the people who got those awards are very happy with them. I was very happy to see Laura Dern win Best Supporting Actress, but I think also that Netflix went for the Oscar, like campaigned pretty aggressively for the Oscars this year. It got, you know, 10 nominations for The Irishman, and The Irishman got zero awards. So I think there is also a little bit of an element, there have to be people in those offices who were pretty disappointed this week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of with the skeptical tweeters. So it's like, you got the most nominations, you won. Kids are all right.
Yeah.
I think they're, I mean, I think they're, you know, I don't think like anyone's like getting fired.
Uh-oh, what's going to happen to Netflix?
Right. I think, yeah. But that said, it is also worth noting that there have been reports about like how aggressive Netflix has been campaigning for the Oscars and how much money they're spending, like millions of dollars campaigning for the Oscars, to the point where they've had to give interviews downplaying it and saying, you know, when we campaign for the Oscars, it's not just to win Oscars. It also means that people become more aware of The Irishman. They become more aware of Marriage Story. So even if it doesn't win the awards, that still has like really raised the profile of these films, which I think is a totally fair argument. But I do think that's part of why like it's newsworthy is this question of like Netflix's strategy. A, like, is it, should it be like going, is it important for Netflix to be getting Oscars? Like, why is it devoting a lot of energy to this? Which I think a lot of it is tied into this question of, if you make a movie for Netflix, you know, can it have the kind of same level of prestige and cultural attention that a theatrically released movie has? And partly because the theaters, you know, the big theater chains still don't want to show Netflix movies. Netflix has, you know, basically taken over a theater in New York, and is basically like just running its own films there. It's in talks to buy a theater in LA. And I think the awards campaigns are kind of a similar thing, that if you're going to get Martin Scorsese to make a movie for Netflix, he probably wants to feel like, hey, this is going to be a big swing for me, and I want to feel like this can actually compete for the major awards. And it's still not 100% clear. If it seems like there are definitely a percentage of Oscar voters who are not excited about voting for Netflix films. And there are sort of reports last year that Roma might have won out over Green Book for Best Picture if it hadn't been a Netflix movie. And so it seems like there's still like this tension in sort of the old guard in Hollywood of just not liking Netflix that much. And this is sort of one of the ways it comes out.
I would argue that time is on Netflix's side in this situation. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, he's got to age out these stupid old
exactly,
voters.
Exactly. I mean, and not even like, I mean, that makes it sound like a 10, 15 year horizon. I'm talking about like, you know, if Netflix, from what I understand, I'm not like the earnings kid here, but Netflix is still growing, right? Like it still has generally mm-hmm. good growth.
Right. I mean, that growth slowed down pretty considerably in the U.S. It's still growing in the U.S., but like pretty slowly.
It's
like
also
all
pretty
its big growth is international.
Saturated here as well, right?
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
I mean, there's an argument to be made that there's a switch to flip one day where we can't share our accounts anymore, right? Like, I don't know if that day ever comes or what, but there's an argument to be made that, I mean, and just in terms of sheer impact and people seeing it and talking about it, I don't think it's fair to say that Netflix has any issue there. It's really about whether or not the people who cast the votes are holding a grudge, and that only lasts so long, you know, like eventually everyone's just going to have to get on board. I mean, Jeff Bezos is like strong arming his way through, right? Like, didn't they buy a chain of theaters, Amazon?
They were talking about it. I don't think that ever happened. But I think they were. There was a period where there was a discussion about that.
You can see, though, how like who really has the leverage, right? Like at the mm-hmm. end of the day. And I think Netflix, Amazon, the new kids have the leverage, for better or worse, to kind of make it what they want it to be, I think.
I think that's right. And I mean, you know, certainly one lens is like, okay, like they got all these nominations. They didn't get, you know, as many awards as maybe they were hoping for, but 3 or 4 years ago, they weren't competing at all in any meaningful sense on the award stage. So
right.
like in a really short period of time, they've become very serious contenders in this. So I think that is also evidence that in another couple of years, you know, that distinction is really not going to make a huge difference to anyone except for like a handful of old people in Hollywood.
Okay, I'm ready to talk about Mythic Quest now.
Let's talk about Mythic Quest. So again, this is a show on Apple TV Plus. It focuses on the development team behind a massively multiplayer online role-playing game called Mythic Quest, specifically, or I guess the full name of the show is Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet, which is like the name of the expansion that they launch at the beginning of the season. It's from the team of people who made It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And yeah, let's talk about it. Maybe I think it's not necessarily a super plot driven show, but we should still try to stay away from some spoilers because there are some interesting surprises that come up later on. Yeah. I mean, what did you guys kind of feel like? Were you excited about the show?
Yeah, I was excited about it before because of the It's Always Sunny pedigree. Basically, I thought I was skeptical of the video game premise because it didn't seem like good grist for the mill of making a show, but I was pleasantly surprised. But yeah, I just, because of the team, I've liked Sunny always. It's Always Sunny, I mean, pretty consistently over its 10-year history now. So
I think it's like 15
I think
years
it's now. Even longer than
oh,
that it's
yeah,
like one
sure.
of the longest running shows to not went have ever have an Emmy nom, I think.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
They're like kind of like tilted about it too. Which I like.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, it's just like we were talking about with the Oscars, right? It's like
I mean, it's clearly like a, I don't know, the cult following behind It's Always Sunny is pretty intense. I loved It's Always Sunny. I thought it was like, I feel like it goes hand in hand with my college years, to be honest. But I didn't know what Mythic Quest was, to be honest. I know you guys were talking about it. It was one of those things. My plan, based on the name, Mythic Quest, mm-hmm. was to shelf it and come back when I needed something, rainy day it, and then you guys wanted to do it for the podcast. And I just, like I do with so many of our shows, I just fired it up. I didn't know that it was It's Always Sunny or Video Gamey. And then I was really excited. And I really, really liked it after that. It was a great time. I think it's kind of like Silicon Valley if it was tolerable. Like, I don't know. Silicon Valley is too much for me and it's like too close to home. All respect to Mike Judge. I think he's wonderful. But I just, there were a bunch of things about Silicon Valley that like made it uncomfortable for me to watch, which is kind of ironic that I'm saying that versus something that was made by the It's Always Sunny crew, because of course they're good at discomfort, but it, I don't know. It's like in a lane that I love, like I love video games and, I love that cast and I love Rob McElhenney. It's just a lot of good things happening there.
Yeah, I liked, I don't know. I liked Silicon Valley fine. I think it just, at the end, I got a little whatever. I feel like it really degraded with quality over time. But I really enjoyed. I did think it was interesting. Like, they've done a lot of stuff, or they've tried to do things outside of It's Always Sunny, and none of them has really been tremendously successful beyond the thing of the show. So I was kind of curious if they could ever be, or if they were kind of locked to that world for some reason.
Well, it depends on what you call successful, right? Like,
Charlie Day has been in like movies, and he plays a somewhat, he's pretty acceptable as like a comic sidekick or something, I guess. But I don't really think anyone else has really done anything. Like,
well, what's her name? Rob McElhenney's wife has been in several things. She seems to be doing pretty
well. She had
well.
A failed TV show, but I don't know what else she's had. Right?
Well, she's been in several movies. I think she was in Bridesmaids.
Wait, are we talking about the same one? Or are you talking about Waitress and I'm talking about D?
I'm talking about D.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I was talking about D too. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I meant by it depends on what you call success, right? Like Charlie Day was also in a Super Bowl commercial. Like how much did he get paid for that? Like how many people saw his face? It's just, I mean, yeah, it's not the same as like having your own TV show, but they also have had a 15-year-old TV show. Like,
yes,
you could argue that the cast of Friends hasn't done anything either, but like they're all good. They're doing shit. You know?
Well, no, Jennifer Aniston hasn't.
I know, but nothing
career.
Really all that successful.
What? Like, that's crazy.
That's the point that I'm trying to make. Like, so, same thing with It's Always Sunny. Like,
oh no,
it depends
no, not
the
at all.
Lens
the same
through
thing.
Which you determine success.
I don't think any of them are stars in their own right outside of the success of It's Always Sunny. I think that's fairly fair to say. And
I think they work outside the show. They don't necessarily. I think stars would probably be a strong word for it. I would also add though that part of it is that. A number of them are like super involved with they're co-creators of It's Always Sunny. They write for it. They star in it. And so like if you've got an ongoing TV show that you write and direct and star in, you're not going to have time for a lot of other stuff anyway.
Yeah, the way that fair. Like another actor would. Anyway, I understand what you're saying. I'm not trying to be combative over here.
Yeah.
Like they've showed their faces and other things, right? Like,
yes. But this to me was like a real example of like they can create and star in something else that can live on its own and doesn't need the reputation of It's Always Sunny and is successful in its own right and everything else. So I thought it was good. I really liked it. And I didn't like the title at all. I think that's stupid. I think it's dumb to call it Mythic Quest, comma, or whatever the fuck.
It should have just been Mythic Quest. I don't think that Raven's Banquet was necessary.
Which I think most people just call it Mythic Quest, so...
Well, what do they call it, Anthony?
Yeah, what do they call it?
Oh, no, I just meant that, you know, this is that the full title is Mythic's Quest, Raven's Banquet, but no one says that. Like, they just sort of ignore the Raven's Banquet part, which is sane.
I know what you meant. I know what you meant, Anthony.
But yes, I don't know if this is what you guys were alluding to, but I did get to, like, interview a lot of the people involved in the show last week, which is kind of how I ended up watching the first couple episodes and then did the interviews. And I mean, I would say at that point, I liked it. I was like, this is a charming show. Everyone involved in it, at least in a press day context, is very charming and, you know, kind of says the right things. Because one of the things they really emphasized with me was this idea that they did not want it to just be making fun of video games, but rather to make a workplace comedy in the world of video games that's, you know, obviously exaggerated and silly in some ways, but also feels authentic to that world, that they have people who are really involved in video games professionally, who are like in the writer's room, like Ashley Birch, who plays one of the testers, but is also one of the writers of the show. You know, she's done a lot of voiceover work in games. And Ubisoft, the game company, is one of the producers, is basically produced the show. They were the ones who actually approached the It's Always Sunny team about making a show about video games. So
yeah,
and they also made a lot of the game footage that you see in the show. They actually created these like little game sandboxes that people could play in, and then they could record that, put it in the show, and so. I would say that, yeah, at first I liked it, wasn't super like feeling like I needed to like binge the whole thing right away. But then once I got deeper into the season, because we were going to review it here, it really got to me. I mean, I think part of it was just as you spend more time with the characters, you just like them more, especially Poppy. Poppy is almost certainly my favorite character, but also Ian in the first episode or two, he just feels kind of like this type of the kind of ridiculous boss, but over time you get more shades of his personality, and he's still like ridiculous and, you know, kind of absurd, but the relationship that he has particularly with Poppy but also with some of the other characters gets more interesting. And then basically halfway through the season, there's this one episode that's almost entirely a complete standalone. You do see a little bit of one of the actors, and then it kind of comes back a little bit at the end. But fundamentally, it's just like a self-contained short story about the development of another video game decades earlier. And I just thought like that just totally blew me away. And that was really when I was like, this show is actually great.
Yeah, I agree with that. That episode was amazing. And advanced like so highly above the like, this show is good, but that one was so much better than the show that it really seemed like it was an entirely different team responsible for it, almost. Like it's great. Not to say I didn't like the rest of the show, I did like it. I was curious about the Ubisoft connection. I thought it was pretty funny, you know, they kept talking about the French Canadians and like calling Quebec to talk to their bosses, which is like where Ubisoft is based, or where at least one of their offices is, I guess the headquarters. But like it felt a little bit like SpawnCon in some ways. And that was a little bit uncomfortable for me throughout. Cause it was like,
how so?
It was kind of like, well, it's weird that they came up with the idea. They funded the whole thing. It was kind of like those things. There was a trend in media. I guess it still happens where like, Intel, for instance, this is a very specific real world example, would go to the National Post here in Canada, and they would say, all right, we want an innovation series, and we're going to pay for the innovation series, and that's all that we're going to say about this. And everything else is under your control, but it's like it's a sponsored package, but you have full editorial control over everything that happens in it. And it was like, okay, this is somewhat uncomfortable, but also I guess fine, like a weird new patronage model for media or something. And you know, it turned out to be much more complicated than that, like because they would come back and be like, you know, if you are talking about this topic, you should probably include XYZ Intel Technologies, like just saying, not to pressure you or anything. And it's like, this is weird. Now it's problematic and conflicted, right? And then this whole show is like, imagine you took product placement and just like maxed it out to the max, right? But they didn't have any of their actual products in it. Or actually, I think they referenced video games. But
so like one of the things that like, I don't know if this is a good or bad thing to what you're saying, but like, I didn't know that Ubisoft was involved in any way, shape, or form when I watched this. And I thought of all the mentions of Montreal, just like being a reflection of the fact that so many gaming studios and like, you know, publishers are there. And I didn't even think about it feeling like SpawnCon or in any way. And I think the games they referenced aren't entirely Ubisoft games, right? Like there was Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah.
No,
they didn't stick to just Ubisoft. Yeah. No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It was more like that, like a sponsored package, but like,
we don't know what happened in the middle.
It's just kind of an industry booster, but it's weird. I don't know. It made me feel weird, mainly because it wasn't spelled out.
You didn't know where they were making their money, right? Like, yeah, you're like, what kind of subversion is happening to my mind right now that I can't see the line between you paying for this and what you're getting out of it?
I don't know exactly like that to that question of like who's paying for what, like exactly what the deal looked like. But my understanding is more that like, it's more that, you know, Ubisoft has a film and TV division that like, you know, has also worked on like adaptations of their work, like the terrible but also weirdly compelling Assassin's Creed movie. And then they were like, well, great, let's develop a show about the video game industry. But like the goal of, you know, maybe they had like a mission of also like, okay, we'd love to just sort of get people more excited about video games, get more people excited about the video game industry. But I think that like ultimately it was also paid for by Apple, and like that the success is also measured by the question of are people watching it. So in that sense, I don't think it's SpawnCon in the same way where, you know, Spawn is more like, okay, it's basically being paid for, like it's an ad and then we just create the content around it. I think it's a little bit different.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand your discomfort. I'm just saying that I think it's not like, I don't get the sense that like, you know, Ubisoft just said, okay, this is, you know, this is the message we want to get. Let's make a show around it and then we'll pay for everything.
No, and my discomfort is not a dismissal or a disapproval. It's like, I don't know how to deal with this now. But it's like not unique to this. Like it's just like this new branded content world where people are doing stuff that you're like, at least before I got the angle, so it made sense to me. It was like, I know what you're getting out of this, and I know why you want to do it, right? But like, there are other examples. I mean, I'm pretty close to this because I worked on it at Shopify. It's not a secret; it's a public thing. Like, they made a thing called Shopify Studios that like created content around entrepreneurship with like a general vague goal of just kind of like, it didn't necessarily have to feature Shopify merchants or like encourage people to sign up for Shopify or anything. It was just like,
I remember branded that. That was content. Weird.
Yeah. It's ongoing. It's still weird. Red Bull does stuff around like extreme sports. Like all these companies do this stuff, which is now branded content, doesn't have a direct call out or a call to action, like not clearly tied to their marketing funnel in any way, but meant to be like generally encouraging of a sort of thing. And it's, you're like, I just don't know how to feel about this. Like, it's not like I don't like this or I distrust it. It's like, I wish I understood the motivations better and understood the ins and outs, right? Like, there's another great example. This one's a bit more clear and direct. With a positive spin, I think MythicQuest is good too, right? So that's positive. But like, the Netflix had a series that was about Final Fantasy, I don't remember which one. Whatever the current online one is, like 15 or something. I don't know what it is, but like the massive multiplayer online version of Final Fantasy, and it was a series where like a teen plays it with his dad, like in Japan, and gets his dad into it, and like his dad has cancer and is very sick, and they like bond over it, and it's a very affecting and good move, like series, but it's also like kind of just an ad for Final Fantasy 13 or 15 or whatever it is. So, you know, the lines are blurring in weird ways, and it's difficult for me to come to terms with, as like there's always a commerce art mix, right? And that's going to be the case, but like, yeah, it's just strange to see the ways in which they're meshing and then kind of like suss out how you feel about the motivations of the various people involved, right?
Mm-hmm. Did the fact that there's no specific Ubisoft product being promoted here, and if, you know, I believe they don't have any MMORPGs, so it's like even in a different game category than they play in. Did that make it more or less weird for you?
No, more, because you're like, what do you want then, right? Like,
I think the main thing they want is to make money from it, right? It's just, well, they think we can make this show and we'll make money from it.
That, I mean, that's similar to the Shopify thing. It's like, it's its own business unit on its own line item with its own P&L, right? But like, it's still weird, because I just don't believe it. But like, I don't
there's
know.
Also the built-in, like, I hate to use the word synergy here, but like, if Apple can get Ubisoft, right? Like, if you think about the It's Always Sunny guys and Apple and the other parties in the deal, Ubisoft not only wants to like make this a line item and put money into it, but like, you would think there would also be a built-in set of resources around, like you said, like the video game clips. Like, that would have been a real fucking project for the show itself to try to figure out, right? Or even like some consultancy work around what things should look like, and, you know, the research around how to make this at least somewhat realistic to what would happen in a video game company or industry or whatever. All of that's like kind of built in, right? Like that is a, it does make sense in a way, you know. It of course like opens the gate to what you're talking about, that SpawnCon thing, but like, if you look at it without the lens of like skepticism, which, not saying you should, it all kind of works out math wise, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I also think like the flip side of that is, I mean, I think that a note of skepticism is appropriate here. I think that's probably true with a lot of entertainment products too, of like, you know, looking at anything that Disney does, right? Is like, yes, it's supposed to make money, often a crazy amount of money on its own. It also serves these other corporate goals. It like fuels merchandise. And so like, there's always like a couple of different motivations. And so, yeah,
well, Disney always feels super like hype, like diabolical almost with it. Like, you can feel like, I don't know if you guys felt this, but I was when I was watching the last Star Wars or whatever, Rise of Skywalker, at the very end when they all hug, when the trio kind of all hug together and they're tearing up, and you're tearing up watching it. I remember texting Panzer at the end, and he was like, it was designed for that. Like, it was specifically designed to have you do that, you know, to have you have that reaction emotionally. So they feel like kind of even more diabolical sometimes in the way that they design things. I mean, think about the designs of like animals and all the Disney movies.
But that's like just how movies work, right? Like, you write scenes to drive a specific emotional impact. That I don't think that's diabolical. I think that's just how fiction works. Like,
I know, but I just imagine Disney with like all kinds of math and data scientists sitting around talking about angles and timing and music and,
right?
I mean, not to say that that's a bad thing. Like, that's not, you know, like, maybe diabolical isn't the right word, but like it's all fueled into like the fact that now I want to go to the Star Wars thing and Galaxy's Edge or whatever, right? Like, I want, yeah, like that all feeds into something else that is much more corporate and profit driven.
Yeah. If they're tweaking just, stuff like, algorithmically, you know, to produce those effects, then yes, that's a different story. Yeah. But, and then, I don't know.
I'm also not saying that they are. It just feels like they could be, right? Like, right. The perception that they could be.
But the other problem I have with the, like, to get back to the, like, oh yeah, they didn't promote their own games or whatever, but they did come up, like, they were like, can you make a thing about video games? And then the creatives were like, yeah, we'll make a thing about video games for you, video game company, right? Like, they came up with the idea. It wasn't the other way around. That was weird to me.
But that, I mean, I guess that's interesting, because I mean, I, you know, at least the way they painted it to me is that very much that Ubisoft was like, once the It's Always Sunny guys got involved, they were the ones, the creative force.
No, and I think that's totally true. I get it, but,
and you can see that in the show,
the production, everything else could have proceeded, you know, the way a normal TV production does, but the fact that it started with the video game company is part of what gives you pause. And I feel the same way. And I think that's interesting that like it could have been, you know, that if Rob and Charlie and Megan Gantz, the three creators, had just sat around and said, we want to make a show about video games, it would feel a little bit cleaner, even if Ubisoft was still involved, than the fact that the project started with Ubisoft.
Yeah, that's right. And again, I like the show. So this is all just kind of like philosophical.
I'm still super into it. I was into it all along. I mean, you guys are the bumps in the roads, really. But yeah, I mean, I think that one of my, I agree with you, Anthony, that Poppy is probably my favorite character. But I also have, I really love both David, the executive producer, and his assistant might be like two people that I feel like could always be on camera and I would be laughing. Like, what did you guys think? Did you guys have favorite characters or anything? Can we move past the SpawnCon, I guess, is what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, yeah. Like, let's get into regular discussion. That's fine.
No, I liked, I mean, like I said, Poppy and Ian are probably my favorite characters, but I thought like all of them were pretty strong. David was a really funny character. I mean, I think there were some of the characters were maybe funny, but a little underutilized, like the, there's like the science fiction writer played by F. Murray Abraham, who's always talking about his Nebula Award.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think like underutilized might be the wrong word just because they just weren't standouts to me. But I also think like that probably they're characters that are best in small doses, including the science fiction writer C.W. Longbottom, the character who's played by Danny Pudi. Let me see if I can get it. I'm trying to remember his name. Brad, who's like the head of monetization. You know, I feel like he would sort of have episodes where he was like really present and then other episodes that he was barely in. And I was fine with that. He just didn't make as strong an impression on me as Ian and Poppy did.
What did you guys think about the, particularly Daryl, as I know that you probably play more video games than Anthony, I believe. But did you guys have feelings about like the way that the game itself looked? Because it wasn't just always like, for the vast majority of the show, the game is kind of irrelevant, but there are parts and scenes in particular where they show a lot of the game and things are happening in the game that affect the plot of the show. What did you guys think about the game itself? Like, did it look like it, to me, it didn't look like the kind of game that could be the most popular game in the world, in my opinion. Like, the cutscenes looked absolutely like they could be.
Yeah.
And then when you saw actual gameplay, you were like, no, 11 million people are not playing this game. Like, I'm sorry. Although, I mean, like,
if you look at World of Warcraft, I mean, right. I feel like that's also like kind of primitive and cheesy. And obviously it's not, I think it's arguably sort of on the downslope now of its popularity, but.
Right. Well, it felt like, when are we then? You know, like, because if we were 5 years ago, then like, yeah, I'm with it. But if we're in 2020 right now and we're talking about, I know they obviously don't reference the current video game landscape for many, many different reasons. But just knowing where we are right now in gaming and what games look like, what the most popular games out there look like and feel like, and what gameplay looks like, that is not one of them for 2020. I just know that.
I thought it was fine. Because again, yeah, like the World of Warcraft plane is good. And then Fortnite is not really that graphically advanced. It's just, it's fine.
It definitely looks better than that game, though.
Yeah.
I say this as someone who doesn't even different. Play it's Fortnite different. Anymore, but I don't know. Like, the scenes where the blood is coming out, I'm just like, that doesn't look like a game that.
It did look kind of cheaply done. But, like, yeah, like, Minecraft looks like shit. Like, I don't know. I wasn't that concerned about that, but I didn't like the disconnect between the cinematics and the it looked like they were just two totally different things. So that looked a little lazy, which was kind of surprising from a video game company produced show, right? It's like, if you're going to go to all that effort with the cinematics, then just go to a little bit more effort with the gameplay.
With the gameplay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, they were so worlds apart. Like, the cinematics were actually amazing. Like,
Yeah.
There was one scene where like a boat is crashing into like a dock and the framing of the camera is like way down low. So it almost feels like the whole thing's going to run you over. And I was like, that is some Game of Thrones shit. If that game is out there, I want to play it. But then, you know, you look at the gameplay and you're like, never mind. I don't want to play that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It did make me want to play video games in general, though. So if we're talking about the SpawnCon shit again, it definitely made me want to, like, when the show is over, I was like, I'll go play some video games.
I think for me, like, my peak period of video game playing was, like, the 90s, when there was a huge, usually, like, the cutscenes were way, way better than the gameplay visually. And so that probably seemed more normal to me than if I was, like, fully up to date with, like, the most, you know, recent AAA games.
Yeah. Are we going to get into spoilers or do we not want to do
maybe
that?
One other thing I wanted to mention before we get into spoilers that I also liked about the show, and I think also mitigated some of the concerns that Daryl was talking about, was it felt like they struck a nice balance between addressing the fact that the video game industry is male dominated and kind of shitty in some ways, and not, I mean, in the industry, not just the people who work in it, but then like sort of the whole kind of culture around it, but at the same time not having that be the whole show. It wasn't like, and that there are, you know, it's a fairly diverse cast, there are a number of women on the team, and that when they're introduced, they're not introduced as the woman on the team, as a woman in tech. At the same time, those issues do come up, and they don't pretend that everything is, you know, equal or great for these team members, but at the same time they don't have like every episode be about like how they're like constantly treated like shit. Did you guys agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think, like, you know, I think that they addressed it pretty head on, and without, like, I don't know, it would have been very tempting, and it felt like they were slightly tempted with this, like the fact that Poppy is as young as she is and is a lead engineer at the most popular game in the world. Like, I'm not saying that that doesn't exist at all and that that's impossible, but like that's a bit of a stretch to begin with, right? Like it really is, if we're looking at things through a realistic lens, sadly. But it would have been really tempting, I think, for them to maybe try to do that throughout, and they didn't. They were like, no, it's not the way that the industry is or any particular company is. And there are, you know, I'm just looking it up right now, global game developer 2014 to 2017 by gender. In 2017 it was 21% female, 74% male, which is actually better than I thought it would be, like to the point where I don't know if I believe it, but you know, I do think that they did a good job though of addressing it. And there was a particular, like, a, you know, I think you guys know the scene with the girls who can code or girls can code or whatever.
Yeah.
That I thought was really interesting and kind of like laid bare that whole situation in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's good. And that does, it's like, that's a laudable thing given, especially where the money's coming from and everything, was that they didn't try to like falsify like that. There was two women, right? It was like, I think
there
they
was
even
three technically, but one was the customer support woman.
Right.
Oh my God. Another amazing character. Amazing character.
Yeah.
The characters I didn't like, I kind of liked. But yeah, you're right. There were only two women. There was the lead engineer, Poppy, and then there was one engineer on her team of dudes.
Well, that brings up a good point, too. Like the community manager, and then them dealing with issues like the Nazis and stuff was also like a warts and all representation, which was good because they didn't shy away from like, a huge percentage of our gamers are actually just fucking monsters, like. And
even in
management,
little ways, like the shovels and the dicks, like if you give them a shovel, they're gonna draw dicks, right. Like
exactly. So I liked all that, and I liked that. I mean, hopefully it doesn't, the problem, the one of the problems that you could potentially see from it is that they like say like, yeah, we admitted this and here it is. So like, give us a pat on the back. But it's like, no, you should you should be looking at these things and going, this is fucked up, and not just like, let's move on, or like, it's cool that you acknowledged it, but like,
yeah,
then totally. Fix it, please. Right.
Seriously.
But and the jail, the server jail, was interesting for the Nazis, right? Because it was kind of,
yeah,
like,
I mean, let's hold off on that until we get into spoilers.
Right. Okay,
are we ready to, though?
All right, cool. Let's move into spoilers for Mythic Quest. Again, if you have not watched all of Mythic Quest season one and don't want to know what happens, you should stop listening now. So I don't know that we have to go into each episode, because some of them are fairly self-contained and I don't have a ton to say about it. I mean, I would love to talk about the Nazi episode, unless there's something from the first two episodes you guys want to talk about first.
I don't know.
No, I'm down.
All right, let's talk about the Nazi episode. And I think, Daryl, you were going to, and I agree with you that specifically the solution, I liked the way they introduced the problem, and I really enjoyed, and so we should say that basically there's a Kotaku article about how Mythic Quest is not just the number one game, but it's like the number one game among Nazis. And they people were like digging swastikas into the dirt. And then eventually Poppy decides to have like a peaceful protest that also highlights a new feature she's built called Dinner Party. And there's just this amazing scene, which I think is based on something that did actually happen in World of Warcraft. Maybe this is actually a really common thing, but I remember seeing a YouTube video about this where, I think in World of Warcraft, it was a funeral, but you know, that basically these characters are hanging out unarmed, unprepared for battle, and then this whole other raiding party in the show, it's a raiding party of Nazis, just slaughter everyone. And it was so good. I loved that scene so much, even though I realize now I'm laughing at Nazis killing a bunch of fictional people.
Yeah, you but, are.
I sure am. But it was funny. I stand behind that. And then the solution at the end that they come up with, which I think is what Daryl was referring to, and which I also found a little bit glib, is they just took all the Nazis and put them on their own server.
Yeah, it was a good episode, and it was like, I think, honest about the challenges. But then, yeah, that solution was like, I guess it's representative of some stuff they've actually done to address some of these problems. I think I remember reading about something like that for some game, but like, it's a pretty depressing solution, and they present it like it's like good. Like they do that, like they do a really dramatic like zoom out on like it's one server and many, and then so I guess that they're insignificant by comparison, and also isolated. But I don't know. It seems like it's not a great solution to me, because it's like you didn't really solve the problem. You just kind of put the problem off into a corner, so that you could like not worry about it anymore, basically.
But like, what is the other solution? Just like
I don't know. Well, no, I mean, nobody knows. That's the point, right? Like, it's still, yeah, a big problem that continues, and like,
it's almost like irresponsible to like tie it in a bow like that at the end. Like, yeah, not irresponsible, maybe is a strong word, but like.
But there's also like an element of like, I guess maybe self-criticism or something, because it's like they didn't just ban them, like they refused to just ban them, in part because they wanted the revenue from them, right? Like they wanted them to continue paying them for the game.
Well, and they also framed it as like a slippery slope situation, which I think happens a lot, particularly with like Nazis and white supremacists, yeah, of like, you know.
They did do that, but then I was happy that they kind of pulled it back to, because it looked like they were going to do that, and then their decision tree ultimately led to like, let's just ban Nazis, which was kind of a reversal of it, right? Because it was like, just do the common sense thing.
Yeah, just get rid of them, right?
Yeah.
And then Ayan had a plan all along, hero complex.
Yeah. But I did think that was the focus group was good. I thought that was some of the funnier parts of the or not the focus group, but the what do they call it? They're like diversity commission,
ethics committee.
The ethics committee, yeah.
Ethics committee. Oh yeah,
which had very diverse because David was putting it together and he was a straight white guy, so he had to make sure there were no other.
At one point, he's like, "We don't need you because we already have your perspective."
Yeah.
Oh, he was very good overall, just as an aside.
He was so great. That's what I was saying earlier. Him and that assistant were some of the funniest. That assistant was so psychopathic. I loved the scene where she was like, he's like, Ian's like, did you tell Pootie or whatever his name is to kill himself? Yeah. She was like, yeah, I did that. And he was like, okay, well, just, you know, quit it with the suicide.
Let's I did it to my bully in high school.
You know, and she's like, he can. I did it to my bully in high school. Yeah, I like, what did she say? She like threw a shake on her and then.
Yeah,
she was clearly was the like, bully, and you then at the end, she's the bully. Like, "He's gonna do it. He's gonna do what he's gonna do, and I'm gonna do what I'm gonna do." And he's like, "No, let's not push him towards suicide." And she's like I said, I can't control his decisions." Like with this creepy smile. Oh my god, it was so funny. She's a great little actress. She's been in a bunch of things, I think, but I've appreciated her opportunity to really shine. I feel like a little bit in this show.
Yeah, she really did. And the other guy, though, I was like, you know, Rickety Cricket is what I know him as, right? And he does a pretty good job as Rickety Cricket, and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, dude, yeah.
But I think he really got a chance to
recognize where I knew him from.
Yeah, that was where,
Oh, my God, that's so funny. That, like, changes things, actually, I feel like, but. Yeah, no, I really liked his like power dynamic, like just his whole character, the whole idea of an executive producer who's managing these very different personalities, all with their separate goals. It's just like exhausting for him. Poor thing. I also really liked the customer support or community manager lady. She was really unsettling in a great way.
Yeah, she's familiar too. I don't know from what, but I do recognize her.
Well, there's also one other big twist. What did you guys think about? We can say that, right? We're in spoilers.
Yeah,
triple spoiler alert. This is a bigger one. That Brendan Hootie, whatever his name is, Cootie, is Ian's son, and the one who was trying to fight him.
I thought that was pretty good. I thought it was a little bit, I don't know. I thought it was a little bit cheap. Like, I didn't see it coming, but I also didn't think it was absolutely necessary. But it did set up, like, it made Ion's character much more interesting and added some depth to it. So that was good.
Well, I do think that, like, the thing that's least believable in this whole show and that any gaming company would probably pay big, big bucks for it is to be able to turn, like, the connection between the offline and online, right? Like, with the Nazi thing even, right? If we saw in the news that, like, oh, there's reports that, like, this game is the most popular among Nazis are setting it up, we'd see all this news about, like, press statements and stuff like that. You'd never actually see like a Nazi raid, right? Like in the game. Like that's like a crazy thing to have happened, right? Like that it's reflecting itself in the game. Same thing with this whole hacker taking over the Masked Man. And then the Masked Man ends up being the most popular streamer to have streamed the game and had a public beef with the game and with Ian. And then for it to be settled by the creator of the game and the streamer and then him be unmasked as the streamer. I mean, like, that is a crazy fucking thing to have happened, and it's a crazy PR stunt that could not be paid for in a million years just because it's impossible to choreograph, right? Like, it would be so hard to choreograph and have it be organic. It's just an insane thing, which I thought was really interesting. Like, it's never ever could happen, but it definitely added like an interesting layer to where I was like just thinking about it as someone who loves games and kind of watches the industry, like how ridiculous and amazing and weird.
Yeah. This definitely strained. Like, I don't think it made any attempt to be like rooted in reality, in terms of like the coincidences of stuff going on or whatever. Or what was happening in the game world. So I wasn't bothered by that because it maintained that through. It was consistent in itself, right? In terms of like how things work. So that was okay. I just didn't. I that was the point. Like Tara put it better when she, because that was the point where she's like, oh, I didn't like that. And she kind of like checked out after that, just because it was like
that being the revelation about Pootie.
Yeah. And I
could feel that. I was able to suspend reality enough to be like, oh, how cool that these worlds are. Like, that worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
Well, but I feel that way a lot in this show. Like, I'm relieved when it works out perfectly for some reason, even though I know that's not how it would ever work out.
Yeah, it was a bit meta too, because even they have the Nebula guy, the writer, you know, he celebrates that, right? Because it's like so perfectly written versus what he thought had happened, which was like...
He's like, the twist that I wrote actually ended up being what happened in real life too.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say the thing about the Pootie revelation for me, I liked it when it happened. I mean, it's like this double revelation of first they reveal that Pootie is the masked man, and then they reveal that he's Ayan's son. And I guess it didn't bother me a lot, but it did feel a little bit anticlimactic in the sense that happened. It felt like they were sort of building up to this big reveal, and then that happened in an episode that's much more about the relationship between Poppy and Ayan. And so in that sense, it felt like, I mean, they had this good conversation that like felt Pootie and Ayan did that felt like, in a lot of ways, I mean, probably like a little over dramatic, a little bit neat, but fundamentally like recognizing like what a piece of shit Ayan would have to be to do something like this, but also that in his own head, it would be something that made sense. And like, just like that they allow at least a little bit of how much like resentment there would be in real life to make it onto the screen. But then the episode doesn't end with that, right? It ends with Poppy's, you know, losing her job offer, feeling trapped in the job, and Ayan, you know, kind of gloating about it. And then the finale has almost nothing at all to do with that. So it felt like they had this big twist, and then they moved on from it fairly quickly. And I mean, I think I'm okay with that. Like, I don't know that I wanted more Brendan stuff, but it just kind of felt like, okay, like that wasn't actually that big a deal as I thought it was going to be.
No, they just used it as a character development plot point for Ayan, right? And you're right, for the relationship between Poppy and Ayan. So in that ways, it was internally harmonious too, because it was like that. That's exactly how he would treat his son based on the way that they presented his character to date, right? Like, it's about him, and like everything he does is sort of has a spin, like just is used to for his creative pursuit or for his own like legend building or something. So I guess that's fine. I did like his ex-wife and like Pootie's mother. She was good in her brief scenes that she got into.
I loved the you want some chicken nuggets, honey?
Yeah.
Like, that was just like perfect, you know? Like,
did you tell him I was dating? Like, yes.
It felt like one of the most realistic bits too, where like you come divorcee come from this place of like, did you tell him I was dating? Yeah, mom, like whatever. I told him you're screwing a bunch of dudes. It's like, do you want some chicken nuggets, honey? Like, it just like actually, I don't know, felt a little bit real. She was good. I agree with you. What did you guys think about at the end when it's revealed that they're in the same building as the capsule episode game developers, and that Ayan has clearly, you know, made himself familiar with that story and kind of how it all played out? Did you guys think that was too neat, or did you like that it came back in at some point, or what?
I like that it came back in, but I also felt like it undid it a bit. Like, it undid their intention in that, because I've seen interviews where McElhenney talks about that too. Like, he's like, oh yeah, we were going to do this episode, and I guess we should talk right about the that capsule episode after this, but like, we're going to do this episode inside that is people, the audience will be like, who are these people? What's going on? And like, it's a great story, but then it comes back and it's important to the plot. And I've read that and I'm like, I feel like it's reversed. I feel like that episode is so strong and stands out so much on its own that it's kind of like the rest of the show supports that episode and the themes therein, as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah,
you know, to its detriment. And I don't know what that's down to writing. I think it's a combo of things. I think those actors are much more compelling and emotionally interesting and relatable.
Performing in a very different register that, like, they are acting. And that, I mean, part of it is tonally that, like, that episode is basically a drama with some funny moments, whereas the rest of the show is a comedy with some dramatic moments. And so, I don't know that, like, if these actors had been asked to play it more subtle, maybe they could have, but, like, that's not, it doesn't seem like that's what they were going for, versus in the standalone episode, Dark Quiet Death, like, they do have, like, they're much more believable as real people.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
I agree. Yeah,
that episode was amazing. It makes the whole thing, like, even if you don't like the rest of the thing, I would suggest watching it just so you can see that episode. I mean, maybe just pull out that episode if you really find you dislike the rest of the show. Like, if you start episode one and you're like, this isn't for me, then fine, that's fair. But go watch that episode, which is, do you know which one, Anthony?
It's number 5. There, so it's like dead center in the season.
Yeah. Because it does stand on its own. You don't need to watch the rest of the series to get anything that goes on. And like Anthony said, it's at a different register. It's kind of like a dramatic episode with some lightheartedness, but mostly serious and sweet and bittersweet or whatever. But so watch that and then do what you will with the rest of it.
I do think there is something nice about watching it in sequence, in the sense that it just, I guess partly because I was, you know, I'd sort of came across it before I really knew what it was going to be. And so when you just start this episode, you're like, who, it's that reaction that it sounds like they were talking about in interviews too, is you're just like, who are these people? How does this connect with the show? And it just kind of, then you just kind of have to accept it as its own thing. And part of, I think, what makes it so good is how different that it takes place in the same world as the show, but is so different from the show. And it's not to say that watching it on its own, it wouldn't be good, but I think like the kind of like, holy shit, what was that, is partly seeing it in context. And so I guess we, for people who haven't seen it, and since we are in spoilers, I'll just talk about the plot of it a little bit, which is that it takes place, or at least begins, in the 90s. And focuses on these two characters played by Jake Johnson and Kristen Milioti, who meet at a video game store, and they have a meet cute in the video game store. Turns out he's a video game producer. She thinks all the games on the shelf are crap. And so they make a game together called A Dark Quiet Death that you can't win. You can't even kill the monsters. You basically just walk around in the dark until you die. And, you know, over time they make sequels, you know, it actually is like a surprising success. And as they make sequels, basically everything about the vision that made the game good and unique goes away, because like, that's how I guess commerce and capitalism work. And then that also they fall apart as a couple. And it's like this very quiet, what's nice is like, for the most part, there's not a lot of big confrontational scenes. It like is in this very kind of quietly sad register, and you just sort of cover this period of time, you know, in this very organic way. And that, like, what really kills me about that episode is just the last conversation between the two of them, where they run into each other at the video game store again. And you're sort of hoping that there's going to be some kind of, you know, chance at redemption. Okay, they're going to get together and make another game, and he's going to do it right this time. But, you know, it's just more this, that they acknowledged that they, that you know, that they did something good and they made money and that's all over. And it just, like, I was totally devastated at the end of that.
Well, and there was that little touch at the end where it said last chance bin.
Right. Notice that.
So right after that conversation ends, he kind of is going through his meltdown, you know, and they show flashes from the past of them being together and them kind of falling apart. And he looks over and sees this bin, and it has a big sign on it that says last chance. And that was just rough. I agree with you, Anthony. It was a great episode, and it was definitely super impactful. I think even for those two are also just phenomenal. Particularly, what is her name? The female actress?
Kristen Milioti.
I love her. I think she's great. She's in a bunch of different things, and she's very talented. She really like kind of finds a way to get up and under your skin, and make you pay attention.
And then, when they come back to it in the last episode, I liked it just because I liked that sort of like feeling of neatness. And because in the back of my head, I'm wondering, oh, like, are they ever going to circle back to that standalone story? The parallel that Ian draws between the two stories seems a little stretched, because I think it feels like the games they're working on are so different that the first version of A Dark Quiet Death is this weird little indie project that is, you know, representative of this one person's vision, whereas Mythic Quest feels much more like this giant sandbox that has like existed for years and is like this collection of all these weird, you know, things that are come from all the different team members and from having run for years. And so I don't think about it in the same way of like, where you feel sad that like something is lost when they start making these like shitty versions of A Dark Quiet Death. Like, I don't know that like I think of Mythic Quest as the same like work of art that can be like compromised and destroyed in the same way. And so it feels weird for him to be drawing those parallels.
Well, so the way that I saw it wasn't so much that he was drawing direct parallels between Mythic Quest the game and Dark Quiet Death the game, so much as the business. Like, because to be fair, Mythic Quest was vision wise completely his. The whole plot of this season was that in this game that's existed for years, the first time someone did something outside of his vision was the shovel, right? Like, that's in episode one, I believe. So that's like a deviation from the norm, even though it feels like people are contributing different things like dinner party and the shovel on a regular basis. They're not actually, right? Like, those are two outliers. But then there's also the piece where, like, essentially, Poppy's really unhappy. David got fired. The engineering team is preparing to unionize. And that is the direct result of the fact that he was only listening to himself, right? Like, and I think there is a stretch to be made there, you know, between it almost felt like the guy, Jake Johnson, or the guy who was in the capsule episode, who was kind of swayed, was actually listening to too many people and not the one person he should have. Yeah. So it's kind of like the inverse of the argument. Like, he was listening to his brand manager and his bosses and the folks at Disney and whatever else, instead of this one person who had the vision. Whereas in this story, the guy with the vision isn't listening to any of the people who might be able to know how to run the business. So it's kind of a stretch in that way, I think, but I don't think it's as much about the game as it is about like the apparatus of what it takes to create the game and how that is, who dictates that and how many voices, etc.
No, you're totally right. I think like that's probably what bothered me, but I couldn't articulate it. But what you said, that is correct.
Got it. Okay.
Is there anything else from the show that we want to talk about?
No, I mean, I think I'd be happy if they come back. I don't know if it's been renewed. Probably been renewed.
But, it has been renewed, yeah.
Great. So I'm excited to see more of it. I think it's great. I think it was definitely, I feel like this is another one where like I spent a lot of time criticizing it, when in actuality I really enjoyed it, especially moment to moment. You know, like, it's a very entertaining show and consistently interesting and funny. So I'm happy to see more.
Me too. I was thinking I'm jealous of the people who have shelved this, like my original plan, because when the hype goes out for season two and people start talking about it again, they'll have two seasons to watch instead of just one. I'm actually jealous of them. I wanted more. I'm ready for more.
Yeah, I mean, I would have happily watched more. I liked the length of it. I liked the fact that the episodes were pretty short and you could just get in and out pretty quickly. I think it's a good show. And I do think that one of the challenges for us is that it's sometimes it can be harder to talk about stuff you like. And then particularly, I think, comedy, because you're just like, yep, that was funny. Yep, that was also fun. That was funny. It is a very funny show and people should definitely watch it.
Yeah.
And I don't think you necessarily need to like gaming to watch the show, right, Anthony? I mean, like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting I guess I come at it from this perspective of it fell into this sweet spot where I know some people who've been involved in video game development. I mean, mostly mobile and social games, but, you know, haven't worked in that. Don't really write about that for TechCrunch. And so it felt to me like I was just familiar enough that there was a little bit of recognition and there were certainly parallels to other things I've written about at other kinds of tech companies, but it didn't have that Silicon Valley effect that you were talking about where it just felt so close to home. And I really like that. And I could imagine that I think probably it seems like, especially in those first couple episodes, they really do try to explain most of the big concepts that you need. So I really don't think you have to be, and I don't consider myself like a serious gamer, and I think you can totally follow and enjoy the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too.
Oh, wait. Special. Everyone should watch Lock and Key. That's my recommendation. I watched all of that while I was traveling this past week, and it is amazing. I loved it. I loved it. It's a show I did not go into with very high expectations at all, and I just thought it was fantastic. So if you're looking for something to watch, I would watch that. Also on Netflix.
All right. Well, maybe we will review it soon.
Yeah.
All right. Let's wrap it up there then. Just as a reminder, you can always email us at originalcontent@techcrunch.com. And if you have some interesting thoughts about either the shows we're reviewing or about the work we're doing, we will read it at the beginning of the episode. We always appreciate it when you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, when you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can do that on any other podcast app. Thank you for listening. Jordan and Daryl, have a great weekend.
You too.